It's my great pleasure to have Miranda Elkins on Into the Mega Dungeon for this special Halloween episode. Miranda is the author of the blog In Places Deep. She's appearing on the podcast to speak about her long-running Nightwick Abbey campaign. When I had the idea for this podcast, Miranda was literally the person I wanted to have on the most. That she's here for an episode that will air on Halloween is a special delight. So welcome to the podcast, Miranda.
Thank you a whole bunch. I've always wanted to be a Halloween episode.
You get your wish.
This is a dream come true for a very young version of me, obviously. The specific context is weird.
We'll take what we can get. Could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your Nightwick Abbey campaign?
Nightwick Abbey is a mega dungeon that is the chapter house of a disgraced group of knights that is now literally possessed by a demon. And originally, I came up with that theme broadly because I like various kinds of horror movies and things, and wanted to bring that in because when I first started looking at OSR stuff, I have since read a whole bunch of sword and sorcery and pulp fantasy, as James Malachevsky would call it. But at the time, I had more limited exposure to that stuff, and so I was pulling from what my own appendix in, I guess, and a lot of that is horror movies. I also was trying to make a dungeon that incorporated a lot of the elements of D&D that were going to be there. I guess no one ever runs OD&D by the book per se, but as close as you can. And so one of the things, for example, I had to figure out was, why are there clerics in a game that's otherwise geared around Conan and Farfad the Grey Mauser? You have Van Helsing from Hammer Horror sticking out here. And I wanted to make sure the setting kind of incorporated that. And I have a master's, I didn't at the time, but I was working on a master's in pre-modern history, emphasizing the Middle Ages. So I knew lots about weird medieval church stuff. And that obviously lends itself to more horror-y vibes. One of the reasons I decided that it's possessed is that a lot of the kind of mythic underworld tropes that are built into the D&D rules, like the doors are always stuck and certain other things, I wanted to incorporate these things. And I also was a bit afraid of my ability to keep notes. And I figured that if I made it where the dungeon is like sentient and possessed, it can move stuff, it can change things. And so inconsistencies can now become, oh, that's weird. It always puts me in the position of being right about what's there, even if it contradicts a previous version of me, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I do love this about Nightwick Abbey, having read some of your material for it, the way that the dungeon literally grows, literally moves and shifts around, literally births things and calls things to it. I think it fits with the hellish vibe. And I see how you're saying you're making a virtue out of necessity there. How long have you been running Nightwick Abbey?
Just in terms of when I first made it, for not one consistent group, I've been running it now for 13 years, which is ridiculous. Although technically, the version I'm currently using, I've only been running for 10 years. Because I originally used a different set of geomorphs. So the current version I've only been using for a decade.
Is that all? So,
yeah. And it also retains like a lot of the rooms from the original one I change. They're still present, though in some cases they've become whole complexes, whereas before it was a single room and things like that. So in some sense, I've been running it for 13 years, and in some sense, I've been running it for 10 years, depending on how you want to look at it.
In any case, for a very long time. Can I follow up on one thing that you mentioned there? which is you mentioned your use of geomorphs. Could you explain what that is and how that works in Nightwork Abbey? Because this mega dungeon by geomorph is, I think, really interesting.
Geomorphs are pre-mapped section of dungeon. The term originally comes from a TSR product that was basically just a dungeon map that they have connections built into them so you can mix and match them and they'll connect in the same places. And around the time I started making it 13 years ago, it was the rave in OSR blogs to make these 10 by 10 sections for geomorphs, which is different from the original product. But notably, Dyson Logos made a whole bunch. I think he still makes them. Anyway, there are these 10 foot by 10 foot sections. There's four entrances on a side, and they fit together in a way that means that you can put any two next to each other, and they connect. Sometimes there are dead ends built into the map still, so it's not, you don't 100% know there'll be connection. But another thing, when I made that switch a decade ago, one of the people who had been playing in my game at the time, Zarkov Kolosky, who has written a bunch of adventures people probably know, he was like, you have this idea that the dungeon moves and builds on itself. Why don't you have the geomorphs move? And I went, that's a very good idea. And so now, one thing I've always had is, as I mentioned, the dungeon is possessed, so it's also alive in a sense. And if you do things like spill holy water on it, it'll sizzle and pop, and the ground will blister like it's made out of flesh instead of stone and things like that. And now that adds in a chance that the geomorphs will shift around in ways that I have mechanically determined. And that adds an extra mapping puzzle on top of everything, which I don't think players find that frustrating. They do find it frustrating to the ability that they will say, we don't use turn undead in this fight. We don't want to be stuck not knowing the way back. But I've never heard them groan about it, if that makes sense. And there's often a lot of discussion of, oh, we need to go back over here to see if anything's changed and things like that. And I actually have some areas on the geomorphs. In the initial configuration the dungeon is in, you cannot access them at all. And so you require...
Oh my God.
You require pissing off the Abbey to make it move in order to ever get to them. And another thing I have is that the deeper you go, the more likely it is when you do something that it makes the Abbey mad. So on level one, there's just a 1 in 6 chance that if you spill some holy water, that a shift happens. On level three, there's a 3 in 6 chance, for example. So it's created a kind of mapping puzzle that, in my experience so far, players have enjoyed. I hadn't thought about this until now, but at least the two groups that I've run it most for, my shorter Nightwick campaign, there are two people who are mapping, and there's a lot of cooperation between them, assembling the map, figuring out where the geomorphs are going. When I last mapped this level, it was this configuration. You have differences. Which one is it now? Stuff like that.
This idea that the dungeon is always changing and always changing in response to the unwelcome actions of the players is really neat. When I was looking at Nightwick stuff just recently, like in preparation for this episode, it was striking me how universally relevant clerics' powers were. There are an incredible number of undead, demonically possessed things, and so on. And so I think, in a way, it ties the use of the cleric's power to a kind of risk-reward mechanic that really ups the pressure in a way that I imagine you would really need.
Yeah.
That is, sure, you can call on the power of the god of law to make something happen here, but the dungeon's not going to like it.
Yeah, And that is obviously a little bit intentional because there are lots of undead and things. And I hope that is a better solution than the Gygax style. All the skeletons have a little pendant that makes them save higher or makes them harder to turn. It's as easy to turn, but if you turn something, you also are turning the Abbey. And where is that going to move you as it tries to shuffle you off somewhere? As it, in a sense, all of the stuff in the dungeon is the demon's immune system, and you are a virus or a bacterium that is an unwanted entity that it's reacting to. And yeah,
I just had Luke Gearing on the podcast for an episode, which, when we talked not only but in part about his sci-fi horror mega dungeon, Gradient Descent. And I do think it's very interesting that both of you independently hit upon the idea of harnessing the mythic underworld to a kind of horror theme by, as it were, making the dungeon a sentient sort of presence that can react to the action of the players, that wants certain things, doesn't want other things, and which is a kind of malevolent force. I do think you've found one of the secrets, maybe, of what it would be to turn the mythic underworld, provide it with a kind of horror interpretation or something. But the other thing I wanted to ask about was this idea that the dungeon is always changing, is growing, is reacting to the players. Does this affect the way you restock and change the dungeon over time?
Yes, is the short version. I restock quite often because, as you noted, the Abbey's burbling up and giving birth to things or calling new things in. So I have a stocking procedure that you can find on my Patreon that essentially, the longer ago it's been since the party visited a room, the more likely it is that the room has restocked with something, with the kind of modification to that of, I roll to see if it's restocked, then I roll to see what's in it now, if I haven't come up with some new thing I want to move in. And if I get something that the parties have cleared out, then it doesn't restock because they got rid of this kind of sponge that I have for a lot of the major factions, which is a bit like a in a video game. I think I got the idea from the way the Might and Magic games handle wilderness stuff, where there's like a cave or something on the map that's spawning a bunch of orcs. And the way I treat it is X geomorph is their home. Then if the party ever clears that geomorph, then anytime they show up on a random encounter, nothing happens because there's a little reward for having cleared that. I then eventually move new stuff in as either it calls out to other things or burbles up something from a lower level to move up. There's a kind of nature abhors a vacuum kind of thing. But you want to have a little bit of a vacuum for a time to emphasize that they've done something, right? You don't want to immediately, if each time they went in, everything was completely restocked, that would probably become fairly tedious.
Yeah, you want to give them their win.
One thing I've learned with restocking is that this might surprise a lot of people, but as it currently exists, I have never actually run level 4 plus of Nightwick Abbey. I have run a decade of the first three levels, which is they're big, but they're not super big. But the fact that they restock enough and the changeover I mentioned also means that there was some. I've done a couple with the really long running game. I had to do a couple of resets. So one of the things that's nice about having an evil sentient mega dungeon that burbles up everything that's in it is that you can do that, and it's explained in some kind of diegetic way.
I did want to say I had a speculation about why maybe your players hadn't gotten below third level, just because I've been playing in a mega dungeon campaign where we have gotten down to like fifth or sixth level and just, I don't know, something like 160 sessions or something. The thing there that strikes me as really different with Nightwick is Nightwick Abbey is very aggro.
Yes.
The whole thing is really bent against you. Whereas, because you can have Mega Dungeon campaigns that really aren't like that. They're like, some factions are just chilling, like they've got their own thing. They're in conflict with other people. But in a way, it's like not, it's not like you're literally descending towards a hellmouth, yeah. Which Nightwick Abbey, I think, really has. And so that really ups the sense of, okay, how many steps forward can we take? How far down can we hazard to go? What kind of resistance? Because it's a very hellish, both literally and figuratively, mega dungeon. And so I think that would really put the kibosh on, oh, let's take a jaunt.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Let's take a jaunt. It seems like we can pretty safely traverse this huge terrain. Let's head over here now where we haven't been. And you're just not going to find yourself in a situation like that in Nightwick Abbey, I don't think.
You can't see this, and the presumptive audience can't see this, but I am nodding. One thing also that happens because of the Geomorphs is they're very densely packed with stuff. There isn't a lot of, it's not quite to the degree, it's not quite to the degree of the very early Gygax maps, but his keys aren't actually that dense, right? There's a lot of dense rooms that, as far as we can tell, are then not keyed, and I don't know if he made it up on the fly or what he did. But Nightwick has, in a 10-foot by 10-foot square, it might have, the first Geomorph has 12 rooms, which is quite, that might not sound like a lot, but in that dense pack, you can't go very far before you bump into some, not necessarily an encounter, but some kind of thing to interact with. It's very dense in that sense. And the term, at least a couple of my players have used, is it's very Warren rather than a kind of like sprawling, empty place.
So you talked about restocking. Do you have stocking procedures? Do you proceduralize or mechanize that? And if so, like, how do you think about that? How does that work?
A lot of them are the kind of standard thing you can find in whatever old version of D&D you like. Of you put in your specials, and then what I tend to do is put in specials and then guesstimate what the math would have been had I rolled the dice, and then try to place the other things I get, like traps and monsters and things, out so that there's not like a weird cluster and then a bunch of empty stuff, but there's more of a kind of balance to how it's spread out. The big thing that I am usually hyper-conscious of is treasure, because that is, in most old versions of D&D, you do not get very much XP for monsters. And the way I run it, I tend to give 50 XP per hit die, which helps you a lot when you're low level and not very much when you're high level. But even with that, at low level, you still are getting the vast majority of your XP for treasure. And most mega dungeon stuff, part of the decision-making process is the deeper you go, the harder it is. Usually at, I think you talked about this in one of your earlier episodes, that it's called a level, character level, because it corresponds roughly to the dungeon level. So a fifth level character should maybe be on the fifth level, although I think all of my players would disagree with that, at least for, I have a lot of fifth level characters who are afraid of level three. I tend to do, like, I want enough treasure on one level for a party of a party of five wizards to level up twice, because they're not going to find all of the treasure, and wizards take the most to level. And I don't know if I've ever seen a mega dungeon campaign that didn't have, at least at low levels, a pretty high amount of lethality. And I think, as you mentioned, my dungeon is very aggro, so it has perhaps a higher, I don't know if it has higher than average per se, but it has a high amount. And you want a kind of abundance of treasure to make sure that as new people cycle in, they're able to keep up that they haven't completely emptied out a level of all the stuff that would, if you have like a new level one guy, you don't want to make it where they don't have anywhere they can go without dying, I guess what I'm trying to say.
So let me see if I've got the picture right. So you are, the way that you're populating the kind of geomorph maps is that you have a stocking procedure. You've got some specials that maybe you had in mind, but then you've got a stocking procedure that rolls like a treasure or a trap or a monster or whatever. And then you're distributing them on the map.
Yes.
In ways that make sense.
Yeah, rather than rolling every time I go to a new room.
What do you think you get from proceduralizing things that way?
I'm probably a little bit more slavish to these procedures than most DMs or referees or whatever term you want to use, because I have, for whatever reason, a lot of little voices in my head that are telling me I do something wrong. And I get two things out of it. One, it quiets that voice. But two, the reason it quiets that voice is I have enough experience doing it at this point that I know it's going to work. The end result will probably not be frustrating. It will probably not be a cakewalk. It will probably lead to a good play experience. So, of course, that never happens 100% of the time. But I would say I have, using that, I have a pretty good batting average. The pace of the game works the way that I want it to. When I do that, is that supposed to short version?
Could I switch gears and ask you about the kind of heavy theming, the horror theming of Nightwick Abbey and what you get from that? So that, and in particular, I have in mind, there's this post that you wrote about mega dungeon design, where you say that a strong theme for a mega dungeon helps you in prep. Could you tell us how the themes of Nightwick Abbey have helped you create, stock, run the mega dungeon?
Yeah. So if you don't have a theme and you just go, I'm going to make a bunch of tunnels and have orcs in it, there's a degree. I know I keep referencing back to your old interviews, and I know James Malachevsky and his talked about inventing it a lot in play, which is true. You still do that when you, but I also know from having read his blog that he knew that it was built by basically elf Martians before he ran it, because that post is before this is the first session I'm running, right? You have to have some kind of thing. If you don't have anything, then developing it through play, you have the problem of what do you put in there for them to interact with in the first place? It's going to be very boring. And obviously, there are certain tropes you can lean on, like a wizard did it. But at some point, if your theme is too broad, at least I find you're going to get choice paralysis and end up relying on the same kind of D&D tropes over and over, which hopefully I don't. But there's...
You definitely don't.
Okay. But you rely on the same kind of D&D tropes over, and you end up with... It sounds like if you don't have a theme, you can have a wider array of things, but it also... Narrowing it with a theme, I think, actually gives you more specific ideas. Typically, the way I think about it is you have the dungeon theme. So Nightwick Abbey is this hell-haunted abbey. And then the levels have themes. So I have one theme that's just like the storage area and living quarters of where the Sword Brothers, who is the faction that built it, and they're now wandering it as the blind dead. But I have one where they lived and worked and stuff. I have a wide variety of horror interests. Obviously, blind dead is from a more visceral kind of gore-focused horror. And then I also like universal stuff. And so I have one level that's the Frankenstein level. It has more Tesla coils and things as treasure. It's got Island of Dr. Moreau guys. It's got weird plants they were growing and stuff. Like I have a kind of mad scientist level is maybe a better way to put it. And by having the overall idea and then go, okay, so I know I have this big, everything spooky made by this group of evil knights. They made a lab to make new evil things. And then I have the lab level idea. And then for each geomorph, I then have a sub theme. So in the lab level, I have, there's a layer for one of the wizards they had hired to make the lab has accidentally turned himself into a hideous radioactive monster. And you have a geomorph that's his little lair. I mentioned there's the Island of Dr. Moreau guys. They live in a little village they set up in a little garden. That's one of them. I have a geomorph that's where like the brain that runs the whole, they have a fungal brain that kind of runs the various parts of that level. I have a geomorph where it lives and where its guardians live and all that stuff. So you have these, a real big theme, a smaller theme, and then a smaller theme. And one of the things, obviously, as I was saying, is you get more specific ideas. Whereas if you don't have a good theme, I think it's hard to not just go, I don't know, it's an orc layer. Not that it's bad to necessarily have an orc layer, but I think at some point you also get to where you have another orc layer, if you will, or have another layer of monsters that's very similar to the first one. Or you need something to inspire you. And even though it's more limiting, it's also more inspiring in that limitation, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
How systematic it is with Nightwork is really interesting. That is that you know what the dungeon is, and it's a really distinctive. It's not like orcs in a hole. It's whatever is pretty far away from that.
There are some goblins, but also the goblins are in the setting are at least a little bit different. And I reserve the right to have goblins because ghosts and goblins is a very Halloween-y thing. And I am on the Halloween episode.
So appropriate. Yeah, no, but this thing where you have this nested layer of, on the one hand, there's the mega dungeon concept in general, and then you have the concept for a level, and then the geomorphs allow you to theme more specifically. I've seen your geomorphs. They literally have the name of the theme of the geomorph, and I see how that's structuring the way you think about it. It's a neat formula. I certainly would agree with you about the general phenomenon. It's so much so with me, I can't tell what's a chicken and what's an egg here, but in my own case, it might be because I care so much about this, but it might also just be how my imagination works. I literally can't do it. I literally cannot create and stock a dungeon unless the area has a strong concept, really strong. My imagination is just really geared that way. Like if I don't have that grit, it's like a grit that pearls can grow around, or it's the thing that lets you operate at two different levels. It lets you be creative both in terms of you're stocking it and you're saying what's in it, and then like riffing on that and imagining and then building it. But then it's also like in play, you can say what the details are because you know what the kind of place is.
Yeah, exactly.
All the things you haven't written down.
Exactly.
That you'll never write down, that you never could write down without it becoming like an incredible boring.
I have a post on my blog about the idea of the DM is a shut-eye, which is an old-timey term for a psychic who has forgotten that they're faking it. And the reason I use that is because we're all making it all up all the time. And in fact, I do it very systematically, as I just mentioned. But in order for me to have the juices work, I have to trick myself into thinking I am describing something that's there.
It's amazing how real that is, I find. Like, I just won't change something. You know what I mean? Under any pressure, almost. Yeah. Like when my mind just says, no, this is how it must be because this is what the space is like. And I will hold that line almost in the face of anything. And for me, that kind of space of my feeling like, and as you say, it's what is it? It's like a thing we're building in our mind. But my sense that there's a there, it really is like the principle for everything. Exactly. So I really like your analogy there. we forgot that we're faking it, and that's the kind of style or something.
Yeah. Because I originally heard the term in an interview with Orson Welles, where he talks about basically playing psychic between movies one time and then realizing he had himself become a shut-eye and stopping. But in a different interview with Orson Welles, he talks about someone asks him why all the rooms in Kane's house, Xanadu, are so big. And he said, because they are that big. There's a sense of describing the reality of a thing, even though it's fictional, that I think as a DM, I need that to be able to function, basically. If otherwise, I'm going to be sputtering and not able to, as you say, describe the things that I haven't written down and that I would never need to write down, the little details and things, unless I have a sense that there's a there, right? I think theming helps you get that, right? If you just have a kind of a mad wizard made a place, you need even then some kind of idea of what the mad wizard was trying to do. You have to pick a theme that's very important to you and very specific to you. It's got to be a thing that you can keep going and drawing from again and again, which is another problem, I think, with the wizard did it kind of thing. Yes. Yeah. You're not going to have a lot of investment.
You have to be able to fall in love with the idea of the place, I think. You have to feel it. Mm-hmm. If you can't feel it, how are you going to live with it for a long time? That's been my experience. You know, sometimes I get embarrassed by that a little bit because I feel like, but that's when a lot of stuff happens. When I have an idea that fits with the thing and I really fall in love with it. Mm-hmm. And it just pulls me forward. And I definitely think like when I think about what makes prepping such a prepping, like you prep a meal or something. It sounds so utilitarian. Yeah. When I'm preparing, we might say preparing to play, I do think that's one of the main kind of pleasures for me is like it's like I get carried away I feel a lot of things actually. And if I didn't, I never could do it.
Yeah.
I never could. And I wouldn't want to keep doing it. And it's only because it makes me feel things that it can hold, has held my attention for so long. I think in a way, weirdly, it's not like it gets less over time, actually. I'm like 8 years in or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how long, 8-9 years in to imagining one thing, just not quite as long as you, but not nothing.
That's quite one of the things I found having had, if someone doesn't like some other game idea I have, I'm like, that person just has bad taste or whatever. But if someone doesn't like Nightwick, I do feel like wounded. That's like a more personal insult. It's like a part of me. Yeah, but you have to have something that you can go back to. And if you don't have that, you're not going to get very far, which this is maybe another thing not to put in because I don't want to yuck yums. But I think a lot of the Dungeon 23 projects sputtered out. Because you run out of well to go back to.
Yeah, I agree with that. For me, it sputtered out because, actually for the opposite reason, namely that I just knew I needed to sink into a thing before I could do it. So like I immediately started like immersing myself in the things that would prepare me to do it. And then I couldn't carry out Dungeon 23 because my timeline just doesn't work like that. It was like a graveyard of ships and that was connected to this ancient history of my setting. Literally, ships were entombed there. And so I started reading all this nautical stuff, like about knots and about the names of parts of ships and like the old words and the names for all the different winds and all the like things like that. And that's what was making it come alive. But I just couldn't do like a room a day when I was
like whenever
trying to seed something. I was trying to seed something.
Whenever I stalk, I do it manic. I don't do one a day. I understand people might want to pace out that way, but I don't know how. I'm either in the mood to do 20 rooms or none. I have to be in the right space. I can't really pace it like that.
Yeah. It's frustrating that we can't control the creative impulse more. It's obviously, this is a huge, well-known phenomenon of human life that, like, that's not, it's tough.
I have a piece of advice for anyone making a mega dungeon. When you're doing it, you will do some stuff that is probably admittedly half-assed, but the thing you came up with in that half-assed thing, it is probably better, at least for getting it on the table, assuming you have that well to draw from, and assuming you have that Jedi ability, the half-assed thing's still going to work, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And the fact, I'm trying to remember what you said that I was, that you don't want to, once you do it, you don't want to move your, you don't want to undo it. You don't want to change it, right? The thing you thought of, that's the thing. even if you think of a better thing later, put it somewhere else.
Or certainly in play. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying there. I just think prep is impossible if you don't hew to some principle like that. It's just not, no one can be on all the time.
Yeah.
No one can be hitting the virtuoso notes like all the time.
And I should say there's a difference between leaving it, like you were saying, not changing it, and realizing it's different in play, if that makes sense. Or what I was getting at with the Shed Eye thing is, of course, that's not different, but it is different. Because I've tricked myself into thinking it's different. And the thing that's important to me is, if the player came up with a neat thing, I know there's lots of DMs that are like, if your player comes up with something better than you, do that. And I always go, I could do that later, but I can't do that now. My hand's off the piece or whatever. I can realize as they're interacting with something that it works differently than I initially thought, assuming that it's me realizing it as they interact with it, rather than they influence me by saying a theory. Does that distinction make sense?
It does make sense. I've even done like hard versions of it where I've said things to my players like, I know I said this thing last time, but I thought about it more and I think it's got to be like this. Because the place took more shape in my mind. But even that's not like a squishy reality thing. It's like, I'd like to do a slight reset, but it's because the thing developed or whatever.
It's more real now than it was the previous.
Right, exactly.
And that's part of why I made it alive, is I can do that and I don't have to go, it's just the next time they interact with it, that's the way it is now rather than the previous way. And if they say, it worked this way before, I go, oh, that's weird.
It does strike me that mega dungeons, because of their being pretty ambitious, I mean, I'm not saying everyone's going to run a decade or 13, 14 year, but I do think they are an ambitious undertaking. And so I do think they pull towards that thing where people live with a campaign world for a long time. And certainly that's my whole bag. That's what I do think it invites, this kind of thing where, as you said earlier, you said, my head is so, I forget what you said, or my head is so in it, or it's so with me, or you live with it. You live with it for so long. It's not just, oh, I wrote down this theme and this concept, but like, it's like a thing, well, like Nightwick, it grows, it changes, you know, it has a life of its own in your mind. And then when you invite other people into their detriment to that, then it's of course a shared and interactive one. I do think Mega Dungeons really kind of caters to that, partly because of the stickiness of it, the ambitiousness of, it's not just a dungeon. It's not just a 10 room dungeon. It's not just a 30 room dungeon. It's like a whole single, an adventuring location. That's a whole campaign. Yes. Site.
And you're describing it on such a small level that the fact that you could run a campaign setting for years and you're in it for years, but you're going from town to town and things, whereas in this, you're spending years going from room to room, because the interactions you're having are so small in scale and personal that the sense that you're living in it is, I think, stronger than if you're doing like the Indiana Jones line across a setting.
Right. Could I ask, so this is a Halloween special, and Nightwick Abbey is this incredible horror-themed mega dungeon. Do you have any advice for people who would like to run sort of horror-themed dungeons or mega dungeons?
The first thing I want to say, because I wanted to get at this kind of, I had a general version of this advice, and I can give a specific version with this, which is that if you want to pick a theme, you need to pick a theme that you're really into. Because if someone else copied me and they don't really like horror, for example, then they're not going to have the same ability to draw up stuff. Because part of theming is that it helps. But if you do like horror, it's a very useful thing to pull from, especially because one of the things that I like about horror is the way it literalizes metaphor. And so it has a kind of what I call emotional reality to it, where it turns anxiety into a monster or whatever that represents the thing you're dealing with, but also has a creepiness that it doesn't necessarily have in real life. And one of the things that I try to do with Nightwick is the space is psychological, is usually the way I put it, that the history of the space and the opinions of the various factions, because even though it's all the immune system of this demon, the demon is crazy. And so it's always working at cross purposes with itself. It calls to things and they think that they're independent from it, that they're actually part of its will, but its will is nonsense and this whole thing like that. So there's different factions still within it. And if you think about what their deal is, what the deal is with the history of the thing, and you literalize that and make it physical in the dungeon. Like Nightwick Abbey, so it's a living thing, so I make it have a lot of kind of fleshy aspects. Or to go with an example from the history bit, there's one room that I was asking my players, because I wanted to talk about this, and I was asking my players, what's a room that if I say this idea, you think of? And there's a room on the first level that has these columns that are etched to depict a hunting party. And in the flickering of your torchlight, if you don't have a like steady light spell, if you have a flickering light source, only when it is most lit do you see what presumably it was originally carved with, which is a hunting party of some knights hunting wolves. Whereas in the flickering torchlight, the shadows fall on it in such a way that it looks like these skeletal knights chasing down naked villagers who are running on all fours like wolves. The fact that they turned against people and became these kind of rapacious hunters and executors of people is reflected in kind of the architecture itself. And there's more extreme examples of that. I will say that the dungeon is adult, so I don't know how much I want to get into all of them. But if you think about a lot of, say, haunted house movies, which I take a lot of inspiration from, they very often have physical aspects of the house that represent either, again, the history or the psychology of in the story and the character. And a good movie, so not a good movie necessarily, I'd give it like a C, but there is a found footage movie called As Above, So Below that is a lady goes through the catacombs of Paris and ends up descending into hell. And she and the other people in it encounter stuff that is like from their own past and things that haunt them. And that's like very the vibe that I'm going for. That came out after I made mine, but it's a good thing to point to. The big one that I thought of when I was making it was Rose Red, which is where I got the idea that if I remember, I haven't seen that in, probably since it aired, but I remember in the miniseries, I think the house makes rooms and the history of those rooms as people are exploring it. So it invents new spaces But being able to do that and take the kind of grimmer aspects of psychology and put them so that you're looking at a very gross representation of it, I find, if it doesn't spook the players, it will at least make them go, ew. There's some horror writer, and I can't remember who it is, but he talks about what he really wants to do is unnerve you. But if you can't do that, then making you go gross is at least like an achievable goal. If he misses the first one, then he can at least do the second one.
Backup emotion. Yeah, exactly. You need the backup emotion if you're going to run a horror horror-themed dungeon. I think this might be a good place for us to wrap up the conversation. Could I ask you, Miranda, if people want to find you and your work, where can they do that?
I have a blog that I sometimes update and used to update a lot, so you can still find a bunch of stuff there at inplacesdeep.blogspot.com. And I have an In Places Deep Patreon where you can actually look at Nightwick Abbey yourself. And in fact, we just recently hit where I have put up all of the geomorphs for the first three levels. So you can run it as I have run it so far.
I will include links to all those things in the show notes. Miranda, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. And thank you. I think it's a very good topic for a podcast. Obviously, I'm very interested in Mega Dungeon.
Yeah, it speaks to our very niche interests. Yeah.